Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. A sea change in the consumption of a resource that Americans take for granted may be in store, something cheap, plentiful, widely enjoyed, and a part of daily life. It's not oil, it's meat. We're going to be talking about rethinking the meat guzzler with Mark Bittman, who writes the minimalist column in the dining sections of the New York Times. He's the author of many books, most recently How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. His most recent article, Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, appeared in Sunday's New York Times magazine, and it is a pleasure to have him on the telephone today. Hello.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
I'm just fine, and thanks for joining in.
My pleasure.
A very provocative article. You are not a vegetarian yourself, are you?
Nope. I'm a lifelong omnivore, although I eat a lot less meat than I used to.
And in your cookbooks, How to Cook Everything, Simple Recipes, The Best Recipes in the World, and Simple to Spectacular, you include meat recipes in there.
I have done meat recipes in every book I've ever written, except for How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. Yep.
So when did you come to the conclusion that we've got to eat less meat and eat more grains?
Well, I think I saw the writing on the wall about 5 years ago, but what was really a signal moment for me was when the United Nations FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization, released a report called Livestock's Long Shadow, which is incredibly dense, long, well-researched document that's available online, Livestock's Long Shadow, and basically announced that livestock production was responsible for 18%, that is nearly a fifth of global warming gases, greenhouse gases in the world, which is more than transportation, comes second only to energy production.
I think of all of the things that I read in the article, Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, the one thing I didn't realize was that the impact of this cow methane is so much greater than all of the transportation vehicles going on.
It's not just cow methane, but methane, as it happens, is a lot of people will say, well, let's get rid of factory-raised, factory-farmed animals, which, is a good idea, and replace them with grazed animals. But that's difficult, at least with cattle. That's difficult also because cattle do take up a lot of pasture room. And if you start saying, well, let's try to replace cows raised in confinement with those that are grazed, A, you're going to just chop up more of the rainforest, and B, the grass-fed cows produce a lot of methane, and methane, as it turns out, is 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide when it comes to greenhouse gases.
We're talking with Mark Bittman, and if you'd like to join the conversation, the numbers today are a little different than normal at this time. They're the Madison numbers. In Madison, it's 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. You start off in your article, Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, by making the comparison between oil and meat, and do that for us.
Well, you know, this happened, as I said, about 5 years ago, I started to think seriously about eating less meat for myself and about writing about it that way. And a year or so ago, there was this UN report, and just a month or 6 weeks ago, when I started working on this piece, everything I said seemed to be about meat, seemed as if I could say it about oil also, which is to say, it's a limited resource. We need to eat less of it. We need to use, let's say, less of it for both our own personal health and for the health of the planet. It's becoming more expensive. It's not that good for you. And so on down the line. And I think, you know, as I finished the piece saying, just as surely as the SUV is going the way of the dinosaur, the days of eating a half a pound of meat for people all over the world are going bye-bye. It's just not going to happen. And I think the parallels are there, and the irony or one other thing worth noting is that it takes a lot of oil to produce meat because it takes oil to produce chemical fertilizer. It takes oil, of course, to transport live animals and fresh and frozen meat and all that stuff. It takes oil to produce packaging for prepared meats. And it takes oil to, the fertilizer that goes into making, it takes oil to grow the grain that most livestock is now fed. So there's a lot of oil going into meat production.
When you think about meat production on a global level, the world's total meat supply in 1961 was 71 million tons. What was it last year?
But you have the advantage of having the article in front of you.
Oh, and you don't. All right.
Three or four times.
This is what
I'm
happened
sure.
to it. This is what happened to it. It went up four times.
Four times,
284
right.
million tons per capita consumption, more than doubling over that period. And what's the outlook for the next, let's say, 20, 30 years?
Doubling again by 2050, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But doubling in the developing world at a much faster rate. So doubling per capita consumption has doubled in the developing world in the last 20 years or so, and it can double in some countries. It can double in a couple of years. I mean, China's the rate of increase in China has just been as it has been of many other things has been unbelievable.
We're talking with Mark Bittman about his article, Rethinking the Meat Guzzler. It was in the New York Times magazine last Sunday. And looking at the response, letters to the editor, a lot of support and a lot of people sharing that same viewpoint. But there's got to be people who feel that that you're wrong. And I think that David and Marion is one of them. Hello, David.
Hi. I would just like to point out that across the globe, there is not enough arable land, either because of climate or because of the type of soil, to raise vegetables to feed this entire earth. We need livestock because they can utilize, and we don't chop down rainforests. There is grassland by the millions of acres. They can utilize that resource to produce protein for human consumption, and without that, there would not be enough protein for this world.
I beg to disagree. I think you're right that to the extent that there is pasture land that's not going to destroy rainforest, by all means, I'm in favor of having animals graze on it. But the amount of food that the United States feeds to livestock in confinement, and that's what I'm talking about here, is livestock in confinement, is enough to feed something like 800 million humans as vegetarians. So that's a big number, given especially that the number of people, according to the UN, who are starving in this world is about 800 million.
David, thanks very much for the call. Does that answer your question?
Or? Oh, I guess we're going to agree to disagree.
Agree to disagree. All right, well, we can leave it at that. That's fine. Dan in Liberty poll is next. Hi, Dan. What's on your mind this morning?
Well, I guess I have a few disagreements with your guest. I'm a grazier. I graze cows, and the whole methane thing has been pretty much taken down as far as its validity when you get into grazing. And one thing that your guest isn't mentioning is that when you grow grain, you're exposing the soil to the sun, and then which destroys the carbon in the soil. When I properly manage my pastures, I'm building organic matter in my soil, which is carbon. So I'm sequestering the carbon in the soil. And I just think this approach of quitting to eating meat is not the way to go. I think we just have to manage things a lot better.
I mean, we're in total and complete agreement, and this is, there's been no mention of quitting eating meat in anything I've written or anything I've said. What I'm against is confined farming, confined raising of livestock, which is not what you do. What I'm against is Americans eating 8 ounces of meat a day, which is way too much for anybody's sanity. It's true, it's absolutely true that good livestock management does sequester carbon in the soil. I have no problem with that, and it's absolutely true that grazing livestock is a far, far better way to use the land than raising grain for confinement operations. So I'm not sure where we disagree here. I think our numbers on methane are probably different, but, you know, I don't think either of us is a scientist, so, you know, what can we do there?
Right, and if I could recommend a website called Holistic Management, and they have a number of articles regarding this subject matter.
Holisticmanagement.org. All right.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much.
Jim,
appreciate
can
you.
I have a word here?
Of course, of course.
Do I have a second?
Yes, you do.
You know what the irony is? I got probably 150 letters after this beast appeared on Sunday, and I'm still getting, well, today it's tapered off, but right through yesterday I was getting 3 or 4 letters an hour. And the irony is I expected more callers to be saying, you know, or more emailers to be saying, you're un-American, meat is the American way, we're entitled to it, da-da-da-da. I got one crank email like that and one fairly heartfelt sort of rational email like that. I got literally dozens of emails from people who said, you're not going far enough, what's wrong with you? Or, why are you saying people should be eating less meat? What they should be doing is becoming vegetarians or vegans. And I think that kind of extreme notion, somehow, as soon as you say eat less meat, people hear veganism or vegetarianism. And, you know, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the way we treat animals in this country is shameful. The way we're using resources to feed ourselves more meat than anyone needs is shameful. And those things have got to change. That is not saying America should become a vegetarian country. And I, you know, it reminds me a little of how polarized things were in the 60s when you'd say, I'm against the war in Vietnam, and everybody would yell, well, you're a communist, drop dead. So, yes, yeah. Sort of feels that way.
Mark Bittman is our guest. He writes the minimalist column in the dining section of the New York Times, the author of many books, most recently How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. His most recent article, Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, appeared in Sunday's New York Times magazine. And if you'd like to join in, the numbers today for this program in Madison, 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Chris in Madison for our next caller. Hello, Chris.
Gentlemen, how are you doing today?
Good. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys, I had a quick question for you. 2 points, actually. One, what is, you brought up the point of methane and how pollution or how bad it is for the environment and for the ozone. One question is, what happens when they take that methane and they turn it into, say, burning fuel for people's homes or for electricity? Is it still as bad for the environment, or is it going to be a little bit more healthier? That's my one question. My second question is, I think you hit on a major topic, and one thing that I didn't hear you talk about was in the projections over the next few years, 20, 30, 40 years of the meat amount of meat that's being used, is nobody's ever thought about what's going to take place when you have a major epidemic breakout or a major disease or some source breakout, which is bound to happen, as well as I think that you are correct that if you look at the obesity rate in this country versus a lot of the other countries and a lot of our health problems, I think you can contribute that to the amount of meat that we are eating.
First question is, yeah, there are people working on converting methane into a power source, and of course that's a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is, yeah, I think that there was some stuff I didn't put in the article about traditional farming practices taking place next door to confined farming operations and the dangers of things like avian flu and hoof and mouth disease and God forbid, mad cow. Crossing over into mass-produced animals and then being out in the market of, instead of out in the market of, you know, millions of people, of hundreds of millions of people, that's, you know, that's absolutely scary. There was another part of that question I can't quite remember.
Chris, what was the part of the question that we have not yet answered?
Oh, in regards to the epidemic breaking out.
Oh, yes, the epidemic.
Oh, the obesity, the amount of obesity rate in this country,
yeah,
as well.
All true.
There's no response other than yes, yes, and yes. Chris, thanks very much for the call. Our guest is Mark Bittman. You read him in the New York Times, the Minimalist column in the dining section. And, of course, you probably have one of his cookbooks, including The Best Recipes in the World, a book that is heavy enough that you could do exercises with.
A mere 2 kilos.
thanks very much. We'll take more of the calls in just a moment. Mark, stand by for a second. I'm Jim Packard, and, of course, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. Happy to have you along with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about rethinking the meat guzzler, the provocative title of an article that Mark Bittman wrote in the New York Times magazine section this past Sunday. And Mark writes the minimalist column in the dining section of the New York Times, the author of many books, including most recently, How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. In about 20 minutes, we'll also be joined by Jennifer Phillips, who is an assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy. And she is a colleague of Gideon Eshel, who was quoted in your article. He talks about the link between what's grown on the surface of the land, such as animals and crops, and global warming. As one of the topics that he will be mentioning. Again, thanks to Mark Bittman for spending some time with us today. John in Lone Rock is our next caller. So, John, what's on your mind?
Good morning, gentlemen. I just wanted to join the ranks of the email that he was talking about and say I don't think he's taking it quite far enough, but I agree with most of what he's had to say. One of the things I'd like to remind the audience is that there's this fallacy about protein sources for human beings being only coming from animal sources, but I'd like to remind everybody that the largest land mammals on the planet are vegetarian. And the link between mammals, of course, genetically and what we need as far as dietary intake is pretty close, even if you look at the primates and limit it to them. But even the cow, that's what you're speaking about, is a vegetarian and seems to be able to get its protein mass from vegetarian sources. So I'd just like to make that comment, congratulate the author, and tell him to keep pushing and maybe a little bit harder.
Well, no argument there. The fact is that most Americans get twice as much protein as the USDA's recommended dietary allowance. And the fact also, it's likely that the USDA's recommended dietary allowance is itself high, because when those allowances were devised, they were done so to provide a margin of error. So, for example, most people eat about 100 grams of protein a day. The USDA is recommending that we eat 50 to 60. I mean, this is average body weight. And then there are many people, many researchers, who believe we could get by on 30, which coincidentally is about the amount of plant protein that most of us get in a day anyway. And the caller's right. There's no problem. There used to be this whole myth about complete protein and incomplete protein. The fact is, it has yet to be shown that anybody who eats any kind of diet that is not filled with junk food, that is any kind of traditional diet, any diet on earth that existed 100 years ago, gets enough protein and other nutrients to thrive. So the myth that we need meat for protein is nonsense. The myth that some diets are better than others is probably nonsense also. The only diet that appears to make people really, really sick, the only diet that has enough calories, I should say, that appears to make people really, really sick, is the so-called Western diet, the diet of junk food, much too much meat, and much too much sugar and refined carbohydrates.
John, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Mark Bittman. Our number in Madison is 263-1890, and otherwise it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Jerry is next in Onalaska. Jerry, what's on your mind today?
My first, hey, thanks for taking my call here. The one thing I want to talk to your speaker about is every statement he made in regards to oil consumption as far as livestock production could be also used in regards to agriculture. And the second one, in regards to your last speaker also, whether you're a vegetarian or a vegan, anybody that promotes that is totally unnatural. And they can't argue the point that if our bodies were made to be vegetarians, we'd have a four-chambered stomach just like a cow. So it's not a point of the protein that we get, it's how we get it. And it's totally unnatural to get all your protein or anything from just eating green material. And I'd like to see anybody argue that point.
Yeah, I don't think it's worth arguing. The word natural doesn't really have much meaning anymore, but there are a billion people in the world who eat vegetarian diets and do perfectly well on them. And I think most of them would have an argument about whether they were being natural or not.
there are vegetarians who are playing in the National Football League. I mean, nothing could be more demanding than that, and they seem to flourish. So I'm not sure that you're entirely correct on that, Jerry.
I'm entirely correct that your body, it's made to eat meat?
No, I didn't say that.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Your body is capable of eating meat. That doesn't mean you need to eat meat.
You don't need to eat vegetables either.
Okay, fine, no problem.
Jerry, thanks very much. I guess we'll agree to disagree. Richard in Rhinelander is next. Hello, Richard.
Hello, good morning, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to thank Mark for his input here today. It's excellent. One of the things I'd like to point out is something that I've personally done, and you can usually accomplish this throughout most of the United States, and that is to buy my meat locally. I've actually had the opportunity or the misfortune, depending on how you look at it, to visit large commercial farms, and the word disgusting comes to mind, whether it be poultry, cows, pigs, whatever. What I've done is I buy my meat in a little more bulk. I invested in a 20-cubic-foot freezer to hold it, and I get my prices down. I know where my meat is coming from. It's not force-fed. It's mostly organically or free-range meat. The meat quality is excellent, far better than what you usually get in the store. And just as an example, my last cow, half a cow, cost me $2.37 after processing across the board. You can barely buy ground chuck for that. So I was curious what the author had to say in regards to buying locally and networking with other individuals if you wanted to not buy half a cow at a time.
Well, a quarter of a cow, sure. I mean, buying locally is a clear solution. It's one that's being advocated all over the place. If it works for you, then it completely works. Here in the Northeast, it's becoming, and when I say the Northeast, I'm in New York, it's becoming more and more difficult to do that because states like Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, where there was once agriculture, have now become sort of a combination of woods, suburbs, and vacation homes. So there's just not as much agriculture here as there was. So the option of buying locally is not available to everyone. Having said that, the number of farmers' markets in the United States has doubled in the last 10 years, and we expect to see that continue, and certainly more and more people are interested in buying local food. And certainly, if it's local, it's likely to be small scale. If it's small scale, it's not going to be a confinement operation. It's not going to be one of these... if you saw the Times piece that ran on Sunday, there was a photo accompanying it of a feedlot in California that could accommodate 100,000 cattle. I doubt that anyone buying locally is buying from feedlots that can accommodate 100,000 cattle. So it's going to be a completely different kind of operation, a grazing operation or a pigs in a sty operation or a chickens in a coop or chickens in a barnyard operation, which is exactly the kind of meat we should be eating if we're eating any at all.
Richard, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. We're also joined by second guest, and that is Jennifer Phillips, who is an assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy in Massachusetts. And thank you very much for being with us as well.
Hi, thank you. Actually, we're in New York State, just up the Hudson River from New York City.
All right. And the Bard Center for Environmental Policy is quoted in the article by Mark Bittman. I understand that it involves the relationship between raising cattle, raising animals for feed, and what's going on in the environment.
Yes, actually it's Gidon Eshel that's quoted in the article, and he's one of my colleagues here at Bard College. He's been working on specifically on looking at greenhouse gas emissions from confinement cows. And we here at the Environmental Policy Center are looking at more broadly at sustainable agriculture. But I'm an agronomist by training, and I have been working on climate change impacts on agriculture and how farmers can adapt to climate change, that sort of thing. And I think one of the sort of take-home messages from my work has been that there are ways in which all of these qualities that we aspire to, you know, convert our agricultural systems to, with respect to lowering greenhouse gas emissions, improving carbon sequestration in soils, looking at healthier food, et cetera, they all sort of work hand in hand with climate change and, you know, in terms of reducing our emissions and mitigating climate change. And they're the kind of systems that we'd like to see. So it's there's some real win-win situations out there, I think.
Jennifer Phillips is our second guest, assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy, and, of course, Mark Bittman, who writes the Minimalist column in the dining section of the New York Times, the author of How to Cook Everything Vegetarian, and the author of Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, which appears in last Sunday's New York Times magazine. We had a couple of emails come in. Mark, so far we've heard about cows and meat, but not all meat is beef. What about chicken, turkey, pigs, fish, etc.? Asks Brian.
Big question. You know, I would say we kill or process, as they like to say, 10 billion animals a year or so in the United States. That's billion with a B. And the vast, vast majority, 9-point-something, are chickens. So chickens are a big issue. And, you know, there's been plenty of publicity about the maltreatment of chickens, battery hens, and so on. And that's worth addressing. Chickens are better at converting feed, more efficient at converting feed to meat than cows, but they still require more than it would take to feed people as vegetarians, and they're still raised in horrible conditions. And frankly, you know, as a cook, most chickens that we buy in the United States today taste lousy. So, you know, I'm in favor of people eating what are called free-range chickens, whatever they might be, and again, if you know, just eating less meat in general. Fish is a whole nother ball game and a whole nother discussion because, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the seas were thriving. We and everybody else in the world started taking fish out of them like mad, and now you can hardly name a species that's not endangered. So fish is a group of animals that is undergoing vast, vast change, and we're seeing more and more aquaculture, which has some of the same problems as industrial agriculture, mm-hmm. and we're seeing less and less wild fish, and we're going to continue to see less and less wild fish unless there's an international agreement to manage our fishery stocks well and diligently. Such an agreement does not really exist at this moment. So at the you know, at this time, fish, it's not even a question of whether it's good or bad for you at this point. It's a question of can you eat it because it's, you know, it's expensive and it's becoming rare.
Here's another email from Pete at La Crosse. It must be kept in mind that the high environmental costs of meat would not be an issue if human population growth was so far out of hand. And today's world of feedlots wouldn't be possible without cheap corn. Reduce the human population, feed grasses to the cattle, and much of these problems go away. As far as health issues go, humans have been eating meat for 750,000 years. How bad can it be?
Well, we have not been eating half a pound of meat a day, 200 pounds of meat a year for 750,000 years. We have been eating it at a much, much lower rate than that. We have also not been eating meat that's laden with hormones and antibiotics, as meat is. Population control, you know, I have no problem with that, but let's just ask the simple question. Is it more likely that people are going to eat less meat or that we're going to reduce the world's population instead of increasing the world's population? I mean, it's a simple question. I think it has a simple answer.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
The question of how much meat, someone raised this issue of, you know, we couldn't produce enough meat if we had to do everything on grass. And in fact, it's true that if we, per unit land area, you can raise fewer beef cows on grass than you can on corn, because corn is incredibly you know, productive, high yields per unit land area. But I've had actually some students of mine make this calculation on if we converted, say, roughly the amount of corn and soybean land in the United States in the Corn Belt, we're talking prime soils, if we converted that to pasture, we would indeed produce about half the amount of beef in this country that we do now. But that, I would say, fits well with Mark's assertion that it's not that we shouldn't be eating beef at all, but we should be eating a lot less. And if it became more expensive, and people who are doing grass-fed and other production systems that are that internalize all of those externalities and environmental impacts, then, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing that we wouldn't be producing so much beef in this country. So I think that that argument is borne out there.
Mm-hmm. And in your article, Mark, you say if all the trends continue, meat may become a treat rather than a routine.
Well, that's a possibility. Can I ask Jennifer a question?
Certainly.
What you just said certainly goes to the heart of the question about population control, because there's also this sort of, well, we have it well here and we have had it well here, so if the rest of the world would just sort of keep it under control, we could keep it that way here, which, you know, is an elitist and difficult position to defend. But one thing I wanted to ask you, let's suppose all of the heartland were converted to pasture raising. I read somewhere a couple months ago, and I didn't follow up on this because I was busy with other stuff, but I read somewhere a couple months ago that the United States doesn't produce enough fruit and vegetables domestically for every American to eat the recommended 5 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. Clearly, if we converted cropland in the center of the country to pasture land, that situation would become, if that statement is indeed true, which I don't know if it is, that situation will become even worse, right?
Okay, yeah. Well, I think that's a fair criticism. I mean, we were just looking at, from a theoretical point of view, you know, what would the world look like if we weren't growing corn and soybeans to feed livestock? But I completely agree that what we would really want to see in the heartland is diverse farming systems where farmers are growing some fruit, some vegetables, maybe a little bit of grain for the animals that can't that aren't ruminants, as well as maybe raising some livestock, producing some dairy. So we know that those kinds of diversified farming systems tend to be more resilient in the face of all kinds of onslaughts, and in terms of cycling nutrients and environmental impact. So I agree. My suggestion that we convert all of the farm belt to grassland was purely theoretical for the sake of thinking about how much meat are we really talking about forsaking if we switch over our systems.
Our guests are Jennifer Phillips, who is an assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy, and Mark Bittman, who writes the Minimalist column of the dining section of the New York Times and the author of How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. Mark, I know you have to leave us at some point. How long are you good for?
Till your next break, I think, Jim.
Yeah, that's coming up right now. So I'll thank you very much for spending time with us today and getting us started this morning.
My pleasure. Thanks again. And thanks, Jennifer. Nice to meet you by phone.
Of yours.
Okay.
All
take
right.
care.
Thanks very much. We'll be back with just a moment with Jennifer Phillips here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about an article that was written for the New York Times Sunday magazine on January 27th. It starts off with the sea change in the consumption of a resource that Americans take for granted may be in store, something cheap, plentiful, widely enjoyed, and a part of daily life. It isn't oil, it's meat. And the thrust of the article is to rethink what we're doing and reduce our consumption of meats and take in more grains as a way of evening things out and making the planet a better place to be and to live. Jennifer Phillips is an assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy in New York State, and she is with us on the phone. Jennifer, again, thanks for being with us.
Yes, nice to be here.
And if you'd like to join the conversation, then the number in Madison is 263-1890. And elsewhere, 1-800-642-1234. Those are not the normal numbers for Milwaukee, but we're in Madison today. So 263-1890 and 800-642-1234. In the article of Rethinking the Meat Guzzler, to put the energy using demand of meat production into easy-to-understand terms, your colleague Guy Donneschel, a geophysicist there, calculated that if Americans were to reduce meat consumption by 20%, it would be as if we all switched from a standard sedan, a Camry, say, to the ultra-efficient Prius. Is that about as clear as you can be on what would happen in this case, Jennifer?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting comparison that he makes. We've done that calculation here at the center. In fact, some of my students published this work 2 years ago in a publication called Acres. And they ran the numbers on looking at oil consumption under grass-fed conditions versus oil consumption through confinement feedlot systems, taking full what's called a life cycle analysis, where you're looking at everything from the birth of the animal through the slaughterhouse and transportation, drugs, inputs for the feed, et cetera. And they found that grass-fed beef consumes about a third of the oil that per unit animal that confinement feedlot beef consumes. So it's a huge savings with respect to oil consumption. There's another point that one of your callers brought up a few minutes ago about looking at the total carbon or greenhouse gas emissions from the two systems. And one of the points that I like to raise is that it's true that both grass-fed and confinement beef cows do produce methane. You know, when they burp, that's the methane, and methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And in fact, it is likely that grass-fed cows produce more because the methane is produced when they're digesting the grass. But if you look at the carbon sequestration that's possible under very well-managed grazing systems, we actually, no one has run these numbers yet, and this is something that I think Guidon and I are going to work on soon. But if you look at how much carbon can be captured in soil organic matter under very high intensive grazing systems, you may be able to balance out the emissions from methane from those cows. So there's definitely a benefit to looking not just at cutting down meat consumption, but switching to a well-managed grass-fed system.
All right. Christopher in Mount Zion is our next caller. Hello, Christopher.
Yeah, good morning, Jim, and thank you for this extremely important show. I'm concerned about two issues, and I think they're linked. One of them is water. Water, water. The intensive use of water, both for the agriculture that's feeding these animals, these ruminants, we're giving them corn and soy, and it's really changing these animals that they require antibiotics, steroids, the pesticides, herbicides used on it. And it seems as we look around the world and we hear the news day in, day out, there seems to be a worldwide crisis of fresh water. When we see how water is being used in these CAFOs and these giant animal feedlots, it seems a crime to me. And Jennifer, could you talk on that a little bit more? Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think I'm actually sure about there being excess water consumption in beef feedlots, because they're not one of the big areas for consumption of water in a feedlot. In pig feedlots, for example, is that they're utilizing water to wash the system out, and in a feedlot they actually don't do that with cows. One of the areas that biggest water consumption when it comes to livestock has to do with the fact that roughly a third of the Corn Belt is irrigated. That whole western edge of the Corn Belt is irrigated corn and soybean. And that is, you know, they're pumping water from the huge Ogallala aquifer. And as everybody knows, that water table has been falling dramatically. There will come a point when it actually is too expensive to pump that water out anymore, depending on the price of grain. Of course, now that we have ethanol in the mix, we're forcing the price of grains up, so it becomes economic again to pump water from very deep in the aquifer. So that is a big concern. I'll give one more plug for grass-fed here, that as you increase your soil organic matter and build quality in your soil under a permanent pasture that's very well managed, the ability of the soil to have water, rainfall, infiltrate, and recharge aquifers below is greatly improved over what it is under a cropping system where you're tilling and you have erosion and poor soil quality on the surface. So water is definitely an issue and is going to continue to be a greater issue as climate change continues to influence our climate. But the question of livestock's role in that, I think, may or may not be the top thing on people's radar.
And the number of water quality problems that are contributed by animal growth is
That's an excellent point to bring up, that I think in the long run that's a much bigger problem. The primary method of, on dairy farms anyway, of managing manure is to put your manure in big manure lagoons, and there are numerous instances where if those lagoons fail, you've got massive fish kills in the streams that all that excess nutrient went into. So whenever you've got too much nutrients or manure in one spot because you've concentrated so many animals together, you have a vulnerability of your water courses in the area.
We're talking with Jennifer Phillips, who is an assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy, and thinking about the article Rethinking the Meat Guzzler by Mark Bittman, who was on with us earlier in the program. If you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Philip in Mount Horeb next. Hello, Philip.
Hi. I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer who helped indigenous people raise fish in ponds to increase their protein consumption. I'm also a graduate studies student from Ohio State in nutritional studies, and I am currently a grass-fed lamb farmer in Iowa County.
Okay.
I have an interest in all of these things. I am especially interested to put a reflection on the issue of adequate protein. I think that animal sources are very important, especially in areas where there are large single-grain crops that may not have the complement of amino acids necessary to help youngsters grow adequately. And the fish pond work that we did in Africa was very helpful to helping those children grow better without kwashiorkor, without protein malnutrition. I'm also sensitive to this issue of methane, and as a grass-fed lamb farmer, I understand the concerns over methane and the arguments for animal production or against that. But I do believe that grass-fed does have that carbon sequestration advantage that you've spoken of earlier, and I just would like to have your guests' comments as to quality versus quantity. I think that Americans are overindulging in meat terribly, but we're not appreciating the quality of the food input. We're focused on the quantity of it. Your comments, please.
Yeah, well, I think Mark's article spoke very well to that. It's true that if we were all doing small-scale grass-fed livestock feeding, the availability of meat would decrease and the price would go up. And I would argue that that's okay. If we consider, the Sunday night lamb dinner to be your primary meat consumption for the week, and then maybe a little bit here and there for your leftovers, that's a very different model, and it's actually more like what people were doing during the Depression here in the United States. I know my mother grew up in a situation where they rarely ate meat during the Depression, and she was healthy. So I think that our whole agricultural system in this country is really modeled on the idea of commodities. And maximum quantity and production has been sort of the goal. And at the complete dismissal of the idea of quality. And so returning to the idea of having greater interaction between consumers and the farmers themselves, where there is opportunity for the farmer to be able to express quality through their system and have the consumer actually understand what quality means, it's a whole different model. And I recognize that it's a drop in the bucket for food production in this country now, but I think that it is growing, and I raise sheep and beef myself on grass, rotationally grazed, and I can see sort of the day and night pictures here between those two systems, and we're hoping that it's growing.
Sherry and Madison, let's give you a chance to get in. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just have a couple of points to make, kind of to segue off of what Philip was talking about regarding nutrition. If you look at the dentition of a species, that can kind of indicate what they would, you know, naturally, if that's the word you want to use, be eating. Like a horse has one stomach, like a human, but it is a vegetarian. It's got grinding teeth. A cat species in nature would have a very difficult time living off of a vegetarian diet. I guess I see humans more like a bear or a raccoon or a dog species, where they'll eat berries, plant material, stolen eggs from nests, you know, fish, rodents, that sort of thing, kind of an omnivorous sort of diet. We've got the tearing teeth and the grinding teeth. And my second point I'd like to make, a friend of mine coined the phrase humanitarian, and she only chooses meat that's humanely raised, humanely killed, humane for the, you know, related species, humane for the environment, and humane for the planet as a whole. And I thought that was just a really great way to choose what foods you eat.
I love that term, humanitarian. I haven't heard it before, but I, in my production system and for the people that buy meat from me, I think that that's actually the primary guiding principle that drives them to want to buy from a farm like mine instead of from the grocery store. It's immensely important that I have a strong relationship with all of my animals on my farm, and I can't imagine having to submit creatures to the kind of life they have to endure in a confinement. And in the literature, it basically says that that's lower on the list of priorities for consumers than the health impacts of, or the health benefits of eating grass-fed. But I think that it's going to continue to grow, the humane treatment issue. It's really important.
Do you have any feeling that market prices will reduce meat consumption?
I think they will. In fact, we know they're going up now, even from feedlot beef, because corn prices are going up. Feed prices are skyrocketed because of the whole ethanol boom. And so that's an advantage to people who are raising meat on grass, because our prices aren't going up, and so the prices will equilibrate eventually. And so I think I'm sure we know that prices influence how much people consume of things, and hopefully all of these other factors come into play when people are making decisions about the food that they eat.
Mark Bittman writes in this article, if price spikes don't change eating habits, perhaps the combination of deforestation, pollution, climate change, starvation, heart disease, and animal cruelty will gradually encourage the simple daily act of eating more plants and fewer animals. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Right. I want to make a plug for Michael Pollan's new book too, which of course goes through this very same argument. His new book is In Defense of Food. It just came out a couple of months ago, and I recommend it highly. It's a wonderful book, really elucidating sort of how confused our relationship with food is now, and if we can just basically recognize all of those factors and get back to the essentials, we'll be on the right track.
Tom and Mekwan, let's get you into the conversation. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. I'd like to say that I agree with you, what your points on the raising organic. I like that too, and I think it should be that way. And along with that, here in Wisconsin, we're facing a quick issue that's come up quickly in our Senate. There's a bunch of senators who are putting forth a bill to increase greatly the ethanol, which means more corn, and that means stripping the land of its nutrients to put this in gas tanks. And I think that's it's a moral problem, even along with other things too. And it's I think they're taking away land that could be used for growing plants for people and animals, and I think it's wrong to put this in the gas tank. And I think that Wisconsin citizens need to contact their Democrat senators right away. They want to do this quickly, and if the bill passes within, I think, 5 years, 25% of all fuel sold in the state, gasoline, will have ethanol in it, and that's a terrible thing.
Wow, I'm interested to hear that that's the case right now, because there does seem to be growing recognition on the Hill that the corn ethanol policies have perhaps been a mistake. So I wish you luck in getting that repealed, because the situation is actually really quite interesting. The water consumption that's involved in processing corn for ethanol is quite high, and that's going to put a load on the system. Additionally, there's a lot of land. I think Wisconsin has a fair amount of land in what's called the Conservation Reserve Program.
That is correct.
The CRP. Mm-hmm. This is land that's been set aside for up to 20 years now. It began in the 80s to minimize soil erosion, but also conserve other natural resources like biodiversity and soil carbon. And right now, a number of farmers are removing their land. They're not renewing their contracts. They're taking land out of CRP so that they can join in with the corn ethanol frenzy. And as a result, of course, all the carbon that's been stored up in those soils in the last 20 years is being released. So if somebody actually ran the numbers to look at the final greenhouse gas emission balance from, you know, plowing up land that has been set aside for that much long, it would be, I would expect that we would not see that we're going the right direction in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions.
Jennifer, thank you very much. We've run out of time, and it's been a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
Jennifer Phillips, assistant professor at the Bard Center for Environmental Policy, and we also heard from Mark Bittman, who writes cookbooks, and his writing also appears in the New York Times. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning and to Cheryl Gasser. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.